This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Now I think I know.
It's the deep time.
We need not just a transition, we need a transformation. It has to be extremely rapid. And especially here in the United Kingdom, we have a real interest in accelerating socio-technical transitions, which sounds very grand. The question to always ask is, well, who's going to do it?
Anyone with a brain feels uneasy about the Australian bushfires right now. They look too much like a photograph of our developing future. Even during the death and destruction, Australian TV and newspapers air voices denying climate change has anything to do with the fires, long-term drought, or even the continuing punishing heat. Mark Hudson studied the whole operation of anti-climate activities in Australia. His doctoral thesis is titled Staying Power, Incumbent Strategies to Defeat Carbon Pricing in Australia, 1989 to 2011. Mark is now working in the UK at the University of Kiel, and he is affiliated with the Centre for the Understanding of Sustainable Prosperity. From the Midlands, Dr. Mark Hudson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, great to be with you.
I would like to spend time chatting with you, asking why a nice Australian like yourself has been transplanted to academia in the UK, but really our time together is too short for that, and this Australian fire catastrophe has left me speechless. Mark, how are you feeling about the heat and fires in your home country at this time?
It's left me sleepless, and I'm not alone. I'm a suburban boy. Most Australians live in towns or cities. We like to imagine that we're Crocodile Dundee, but most people are city folk. And so I don't claim any particular kinship with small towns that have been burnt to the ground. But I've holidayed in those places. I have friends and acquaintances from those places. And if you're a human being, you just look at that and you think of the death and the destruction for human beings, but also all those species, and the functional extinction for a lot of them. And you ask me how I feel. I feel angry, devastated, all the usual cliches. But there's a lot of anger because this, as I said in one of the articles that I've had published, this is not a tragedy because a tragedy is kind of inevitable. And what we're seeing now is part of the consequences of deliberately not taking action 30 years ago, before many of your listeners will have even been born. We were warned, and in Australia we were warned early and well by very good scientists, one of whom I've interviewed for my PhD, and you couldn't have asked for better science and better scientists. And what is happening now is because the Australian state and Australian corporate interests were very successful in stopping any meaningful action on climate change.
You did a deep dive into fossil fuel lobby groups in Australia. Did you find links between climate denial institutions in Australia and in America?
Yes, but there are two caveats that I would make, or one major caveat, which is that by about 1994, there had been a conscious decision within the higher reaches of the big mining companies not to use climate denial themselves because it would cost them credibility and because at one point it would have cost them access to the senior decision makers. That is not to say that there are not links. So there is a book by an Australian academic called Dominic Kelly. He and I have been in touch where he explored these more deeply. Then you have a company in Australia that got bought out by BHP but was very active in the 70s, 80s and well into the 90s called Western Mining Company. And it's CEO was a chap called Hugh Morgan, who is still alive, who is kind of the archetypal climate denier. And he had an offsider, a chap called Ray Evans. And you can, and they weren't particularly secret about this. Ray Evans attended the United States meetings of groups like the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation. And so there is interplay, and then various speakers like Pat Michaels. But they were present in Australia, especially in the early 90s, and then again in the mid-late 2000s. It's kind of more an arm's-length relationship. So, for example, in Australia, there's a right-wing think, or a libertarian, it wants to call itself, think tank, called the Institute for Public Affairs. And they're very secretive about their funding. They used to get more funding from fossil fuel companies, but the fossil fuel companies stopped doing that, not so much because of the climate denial, but because of the attitude towards Indigenous affairs. There are climate deniers in Australia. They are funded by international and capitalist interests. The Heartland Institute, that your listeners may know from the United States, that was involved in various conferences in 2010, 11, 12 in Australia, which were particularly hot years for climate change and climate change denial. But a direct link where the elite CEOs are sitting down and saying, how are we going to stop climate policy from happening? I know, let's give money to this climate denial organization and that will work. That's not what happened in Australia. It was a lot more sophisticated and cunning and ultimately effective.
So the current Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, was previously Managing Director of Tourism Australia.
And, he was.
Yes, and tourism is now bigger financially and employs far more people in Australia than coal. Does Scott Morrison and the people he represents really believe tourists are going to come for the vast burned-out landscape, the annual smoke clouds, or the dead coral reefs? I mean, it's nuts.
You'd have to ask him, but maybe we'll have a Mad Max amusement park the size of a continent. I don't know. A couple of things. You point to the gap between sort of tourism as an employer, tourism jobs, and the mining jobs. And I wrote an article about 3 years ago called Wind Beneath Their Contempt, How Australian Policymakers, or Why Australian Policymakers Hate Wind and Solar. And one of the points I made is that there's a masculinity thing going on. So jobs in mining are men's jobs. Jobs in tourism, where you're a waiter or a tour guide or a scuba instructor, they're kind of effeminate. And so there's a cultural dimension. The other thing that I'd say is that there's a wonderful PhD thesis, which is, now there's not words you don't hear often, which is actually freely available on the internet. And it was written by a chap who asked exactly the kind of question you're asking. How come all the other sectors which were going to be affected by climate change, whether it was the insurance industry or banking or agriculture or tourism, how come when it mattered, they were so silent on the issue of climate policy? And so what this guy did, his name is Guy Pearce, not the actor, but a different Guy Pearce, is he was able to interview lobbyists from all the different trade associations, the Tourism Board of Australia or whatever it was called at the time. This is before Scott Morrison turned up on the scene. And ultimately, he wrote a PhD thesis about business power and Australia, where he concluded that the mining industry had been able to effectively elbow everyone else out to get a complete monopoly on the ears of ministers and to convince the policymakers that mining jobs were it, mining jobs were the future. And as I said, it's a wonderful PhD. It caused a bit of a stink in Australia back in 2006-07. It's sort of considered as, it was the first book that talked about the so-called greenhouse mafia hypothesis, which I've just laid out. As for what Scott Morrison believes, I think one of the things that hasn't been mentioned quite so much, and I can understand why it hasn't, is that Scott Morrison is a Pentecostalist. Now, I have no problem with what people believe. They can believe what they like. But one of the interesting things about Pentecostalism is that unlike many other strands of Christianity, it doesn't have a stewardship strand. And no one's been able to get Scott Morrison to actually say what he believes about the rapture and what's going to happen on planet Earth? And I think that question might be worth asking if a journalist was able to get him to give a straight answer.
Well, you know, I learned from you that Scott Morrison took his infamous lump of coal to the Australian Parliament during an incredible heat wave there, right during the heat wave. So I then realized, well, maybe we should expect to see the most vulgar denial exactly when climate tragedies strike. That's when the big boys fear the public might wake up.
It's also, I think, if you scratch the surface, they at least some of these people are not stupid. I mean, I wouldn't say that every Australian parliamentarian is an Einstein in waiting, but then I wouldn't say that of the UK Parliament either, or Manchester, where I'm from. But yeah, look, when reality is breaking through, that's when you tend to double down on your denial. And we know that from people who are, you know, about to die of alcoholism or whatever. It's when the consequences are really piling up that you become most vehement in saying something is not happening. That lump of coal that he waved around in Parliament, he'd been given to him by the Peak Mining Body, the Minerals Council of Australia, and they had lacquered it so it wouldn't smudge on his hands. And he waved it around as the electricity grid in New South Wales was basically buckling under the pressure. Because, of course, when there's a heat wave, people switch on their air conditioning and demand goes through the roof. And then the coal-fired power stations, which are pretty old, can't cope.
Radio EcoShock.
With Climate Australia still kind of driving around without seatbelts, the country had that crude seatbelt in their carbon pricing, but even that was thrown out, apparently, to please the coal lobby. You studied that history of white Australia's guarding the bastion of coal and along with a coal workers' union. Is there a lesson there for all of us, though, Mark Hudson?
Oof, there are many lessons from the way that climate policy has been made in Australia, all of them object lessons, you know, don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other. First, I'd like to say that we sometimes get fixated on carbon pricing as, you know, a viable solution, and I'd say two things. One is carbon pricing, if it had been implemented in the late 1980s, early 1990s, could have been a big part of fixing things. I'm not ideologically opposed to markets in certain circumstances. I would argue that there are always issues around markets and that a carbon tax, a different form of pricing, would have been preferable, not because it's more economically efficient, but because it's easier to explain. But because we've left it so late, carbon pricing, whether it's a tax or an emissions trading scheme, becomes less significant. You're going to need much bigger amounts of state intervention, economic dislocation, and you're going to need a ton of luck because we haven't done anything for the last 30 years. So having said that, coming back to the question around carbon pricing and how it was demolished in Australia, there are a series of what-ifs and if-buts and so forth. I think what, if I were to sum it up in a nutshell, happened, or the lesson is, it's quite easy for however you want to determine, call it, you know, right-wing or big business or incumbent forces who are interested in preserving the status quo to throw enough mud that eventually some of it sticks. And between sort of 2008 and 2012-13, there was an enormous effort to paint climate change as something that only inner city, pointy-headed, latte-sipping, effete intellectuals believed in, and that it was probably a hoax, and that if any action were taken on climate change, it would destroy the Australian economy virtually overnight. I know I sound like I'm exaggerating, but you know I can go back and find you statements that were not that different. So there was one town that had a steel mill, and according to Tony Abbott, who became Prime Minister and repealed the climate pricing legislation, it would be wiped off the map. And of course, the carbon price came in, and Whyalla was not wiped off the map. So the lesson is, and I suppose it's one that we're learning even more now with fake news and bots on the internet that can pretend to be trusted sources but are actually sort of crowding out the truth, is that the public is, if enough money is thrown at it, the public might get confused about what policies are in the best interests of all citizens versus what are in the interest of the rich people who are benefiting from the status quo, who would like to keep benefiting from the status quo. Does that answer your question?
It does.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Mark Hudson. He's currently in Manchester, a transplanted Australian, and we're talking about the fires in Australia and a burning world. Do you think, Mark, that white people assume that only white people can solve the climate crisis? And by white people, I probably just mean white men.
If you're asking me if Australia is a racist, sexist hellhole, hell yeah. look, your listeners are in Canada, and I probably don't need to explain to your listeners what a settler colony is. And
We have listeners in Australia. You're talking to Australia right now, my friend.
Yeah, I grew up when the White Australia policy, the clue is in the name, had only been abolished sort of officially, I think a year or two after I was born. And I grew up in a city, Adelaide, which is still pretty white, but when I was growing up, it was astonishingly white. And the article that I mentioned earlier, Wind Beneath Their Contempt, kind of touches on this without being explicit enough about the particular history of Australia as a settler colony. But very quickly, if you think back to the 1950s, we thought we'd have holidays on the moon, electricity too cheap to meter, and that essentially white, technologically minded, heterosexual men would dominate nature and control everything. And then in the space of sort of 15 years, between about 1960 and 1975, you have the Black Civil Rights Movement, you have second wave feminism, you have gay rights, and you also have the ecology movement coming onto the scene. And then in that 15-year period, the dream of total control by white heterosexual men over nature is just destroyed. And we're still kind of living with the psychological consequences of that. And that's around the world. And if you throw in settler colonialism on top of that, you get a very potent mix. And so this sort of willful denial of limits and this idea that somehow we are always going to be able to conquer and deal with the consequences of our previous environmental actions that have impinged on the environment. It's very strong, and it's very hard to let go of because it's quite terrifying to realize that we're on a fragile planet and we've done it a lot of damage. And I think that's what's coming through with the fires where you started the conversation. A lot of people are looking at that and going, oh, bugger. This is out of our control. And when people are out of control, they get very scared.
Now, your research shows how industry weathers short-term public demand for climate action and then returns the whole system to the normal or worse every time. If climate activists understand that mechanism, could that help them somehow overcome the industry's strong defensive game?
If you're asking me whether activists should learn from history and sociology, yes, they should. I spend a lot of my time thinking about this, talking about this, and writing about this. It's one of the motivations for writing for this website, The Conversation. I don't get paid a penny. And just today, I saw that one of the articles I wrote has been republished by a major private media conglomerate, and I still don't get a penny. I don't mind that. I knew those were the rules of the game when I came into it. But I just want to say that, yes, as an academic, or as an activist, and now as an academic, I have always felt that there was a hell of a lot to learn from Indigenous peoples and their struggles, because they have been on the pointy end of what we are now, or what we're doing, for a long time, and from our own histories. And those histories tend to get forgotten. So waves of concern about the environment and climate specifically have traditionally lasted 2 or 3 or 4 years. And as you say, the big companies have learned how to concede a little ground, most of which they're going to be able to reclaim a year or two or three later when nobody is watching. A policy can be watered down and eventually binned. And you see it on a local level in my city where I live now, Manchester. In terms of the dangers for especially Australian climate activists, I've written a paper which I've submitted to a journal or comment piece, and I'll give you a précis. I think over the next 10 years, you might actually see a decarbonisation of the Australian energy and transport systems, or a much quicker decarbonisation than we're currently anticipating, because these fires will motivate and galvanise, and with the right combinations of sort of political skill and cultural skill, you could see coalitions emerging where rooftop solar becomes even more important and battery storage kicks off and the transport system becomes electrified. So it may be that in 10 years' time, Australia, instead of being horrifically high in its per capita carbon footprint, is actually at the lower end of the international, or of the rich countries. That's not impossible. It may not happen, but that's not impossible. What I think is very, very unlikely is that Australia will stop exporting fossil fuels. The infrastructure there is there for coal and for liquefied natural gas. It is that infrastructure has been assiduously built over the last 50 years, and lots of public money has been spent on it. I think the only thing that will stop Australia exporting that is good old-fashioned market forces if the customers on the other end don't need it or don't want it. But the domestic possibilities for an effective resistance to Australia's export of fossil fuels, I hope I'm wrong. I wish I were wrong, but I just don't see it happening.
I think it's going to drive a geopolitical change in that part of Asia and the Southern Hemisphere, where there will be pressure from Europe and hopefully North America, possibly even sanctions for people who produce coal and natural gas.
Oh, they've been talking about that for a long time. And yes, maybe you're right. I hope you're right. I struggle to see the North Americans, either the Canadians or the United States, instituting sanctions on fossil fuel exports, especially since America has been benefiting from the fracking boom. And the Canadians and their tar sands, I hope you're right. Europeans, maybe. Japanese, maybe. Chinese, less likely.
Although the Japanese have been a big buyer for Australian coal. But the one that really worries me is India. I think India is planning out their coal future on Australian coal.
There's reasons for hope there in the terms of the price of solar power in India is dropping precipitously, and there are big movements afoot within various Indian states. And I should preface what I'm saying with, I am not an expert on India. But, you know, when you burn coal, there are enormous local air quality issues, especially regardless of what kind of coal you burn, and Australian coal is supposed to be, well, is, quote, more clean or more pure. But nonetheless, you always have big air quality issues, and it's not clear to me that India will continue with its appetite for coal that seemed a few years ago to be insatiable. That may not be the case.
Now, you talk about recurring windows for climate action, but my recent guest on the radio show, Dr. Nate Hagen, suggests that we're not going to do anything about climate change because we are also completely invested on it and dependent on it, even for our food system. So he doesn't see any action coming until a big, big crash of the system, possibly a financial crash. What do you think?
I think he's quite probably right. In terms of waves of public, I suppose what you'd need to do is distinguish between waves of public attention on an issue and actual policy that bites deep and changes the system. So the very quick history, and I mean, this is crude, would look like first wave of environmental concern from about 69 to 72, 73, or overpopulation. Malthus, says the famous book by Third Time Lucky movie with Charlton Heston, where he plays a cop, overpopulation. Soylent Green. Got there in the end. Soylent Green.
Oh, Soylent Green.
And then that kind of gets resolved because you have the big international conference in Sweden, and then the oil shock hits at the end of 73, and everyone forgets about the birds and the bees being drowned out or whatever, and is more concerned about standard of living issues. Then from the mid-80s to about 92, you have Amazon rainforest, ozone, and climate change. And that kind of dies down because the Americans win the Cold War, and there's the Rio Earth Summit. So people kind of think, well, there's now a bureaucracy in place, there's an agreement, we need to give it time to work out. Then from about 2006 to 2009, you have Al Gore and the Inconvenient Truth, you have the IPCC's report, you have the Kyoto Protocol finally comes in, and then it all leads up to Copenhagen, and then it goes away with a damp squib, and everyone kind of retreats and licks their wounds. Then from about the end of 2018, you have Greta Thunberg, you have the IPCC's report that says 1.5 got to be done in 12 years or all toast. I'm paraphrasing. You've got Extinction Rebellion. And, yeah, we're in the middle of another wave, and I suspect that by about 2021, people will have gotten bored of the story. People will have realized that it's hopeless and helpless. And I think your guest, Nat Hagen, is right. The number of changes that you would need to make to the transport system, to the energy system, to the food system are enormous, and these systems interlock. In academia, we talk about a nexus, so there's a water, energy, transport nexus, which means that within each individual system, you have inertia, you have pushback when you try to change things, you have vested interests, you have what we call path dependencies and sort of cognitive lock-in. Academics are very good at inventing new labels. that's their stock in trade. But what it ultimately adds up to is that we need not just a transition, we need a transformation. It has to be extremely rapid. And especially here in the United Kingdom, we have a real interest in accelerating socio-technical transitions, which sounds very grand. The question to always ask is, well, who's going to do it? Is it going to be the policymakers who've been doing it on status quo grounds for 30 years? Why would they suddenly wake up one morning and commit career suicide? Is it going to be the trades unions? Well, no, because they're invested in the current system. Is it going to be the politicians? Well, no, they're thinking about the next election. So who's it going to be then? And there's always a sort of a smudgy answer of, oh, well, civil society, or sometimes people will say social movements. But, you know, social movements get exhausted, they get co-opted, they get repressed, they get confused, or they're confused from the beginning. So, yeah, look, the prospects for meaningful change are extremely remote. I mean, I don't know if you saw this about me, I chose not to have children. In 2004, I'd been together for a year or two with the woman who's now my wife, and we had the discussion, and I had a vasectomy. Not because of what I thought my child would do to our precious, precious planet, but because of what the world would be like by the time my child, say born in 2005, would be like by the time it was my age, 30. I mean, so I chose to have a vasectomy.
Right. And well, now, they say think globally, act locally. What is happening? you're doing that for sure. Well, what is happening with climate activism in Manchester?
There's an upsurge of people doing actions, which is apparently what activism is. Very quickly, 10 years ago, the city council, the city government made a set of promises on climate change. I know this because I was part of the people who forced them to do it and to make it quite radical. They spent 10 years not doing the things that they promised to do. We forced them to make a new set of promises. So it's kind of like Groundhog Day, but without Bill Murray learning anything, which is kind of a tragedy, not a comedy. And so last July, the City Council unanimously voted for a climate emergency declaration with 23 distinct promises of things that it would do. We knew that they weren't going to probably be keeping that many of those promises very quickly. So we'd already set up a group called Climate Emergency Manchester, and we do these reports every 3 months called Hung, Drawn, and Quarterly, where we submit Freedom of Information Act requests to the council about all the different elements of their climate action plan. And then we produce a written report that we put up online, and we say, well, here's the gap between your rhetoric and your reality. And the council are slightly less than happy about us doing that. But in terms of how much will change, it's the future, isn't it? We don't know for sure. we will keep pressing for real action, and if and when they start taking real action, we'll applaud them. But that's probably going to be a while.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Mark Hudson. He's currently in Manchester, a transplanted Australian, and we're talking about the fires in Australia and a burning world. All right, now, from the understanding that I can't broadcast any swear words, from the activist standpoint, what do you expect at the COP26 in Scotland?
I expect some protesters will get physically damaged at those protests. I expect a lot will get psychologically damaged and burnt out. I think that Glasgow, which is the COP26, and it's happening from the 9th to the 20th of November, is going to be an enormous energy suck and opportunity for people to do performative burnout. I remember 5-6 years ago when people were mobilizing for Paris, and I certainly remember 10 years ago when they were that was 2015, and 10 years ago, 11 years ago, when Copenhagen, last chance to save the world, we've all got to go. And then when it was a failure, within a couple of months, all the momentum had drained from the climate movement, when you open a fist and you open your palm and the fist is gone. It just vanished almost overnight. So I am encouraging people to think differently about what their activism is focused on in 2020. I know that I'm going to fail, and I know that most people are going to think that Glasgow is the be-all and end-all. The meeting itself will produce the usual fireworks that these do. Depends on whether Trump is still president or not, to some extent. The Australians will probably still be recalcitrant. The Saudis, the Europeans will bicker among themselves, but eventually produce a united front. The Chinese will do what the Chinese do, whatever that is. The developing world countries will beg for faster action as they sink beneath the waves. The activists will be there in their numbers, hoping, ironically, that Glasgow will be unseasonably warm in November, because it gets pretty cold up there. It's kind of like Labrador, I guess. And then by December or January, there will be a lot of disconsolate, physically and emotionally exhausted people, and it will be that much harder to get them to engage in local action. Now, that's quite a bleak view, and again, as I've said several times, I hope I'm wrong. I don't know why I would be wrong. I think this is a relatively safe bet on my part, and we within Climate Emergency Manchester, one of our goals for this year is to offer a safe haven for people who either choose not to go to Glasgow or who after Glasgow still want to do activism but can't face the sort of noisy, physically draining and threatening situations that big conferences like that produce.
Well, we've got to wrap this up, but Mark Hudson, here's the question that a lot of scientists talk to me about via email, but not so much publicly. And the question is, are we going to save ourselves or is it too late?
Kafka said, there's hope, but not for us. I think because we have failed to take action since 1988, or because we've just kept making things worse by building new pipelines, new cars, new airports, by not helping the developing world contain population growth, though I don't want to say that poor people are to blame for this. Because of all those things, I think it's extremely unlikely that the current human civilization will persist for very much longer. If you pressed me, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, but I don't think we're going to tech out, and I don't think we're going to have the whole Star Trek sort of Federation, gleaming cities and warp speed, that's off the table. I think it's going to be much closer to sort of the Mad Max dystopia. Again, I hope I'm wrong, but I don't see any reason why I would be.
From the UK and Keele University, we've been speaking with Australian Dr. Mark Hudson. Find him at markhudson.net, and Mark is spelled with a C. My thanks to Australian author Guy Murphy for leading me to you, Mark, and thanks so much for sharing your time with our listeners.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. And if anyone wants to get in contact with me, they can find me on Twitter at Mark, that's with M-A-R-C-S-R, Hudson, H-U-D-S-O-N. No trolls, please. I'll just mute you or block you.
Right you are. I'll put all that in my own blog at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
American media brags the U.S. will again become the world's largest exporter of what I call climate-wrecking fossil fuels. But the biggest American coal companies went bankrupt, and now the largest U.S. natural gas company lost billions while their stock became, well, junk. That clash of messages comes with reports that fracking companies are blasting large quantities of methane straight into the atmosphere instead of selling it as a product, as natural gas. To figure out what is going on, we have Nick Cunningham on the line with a master's in international relations and international economics from Johns Hopkins. Nick often publishes at oilprice.com and many other places. He's a widely published independent reporter on the oil and gas industry. From Portland, Oregon, Nick Cunningham, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Nick, let's start out with this. Can you please explain for our listeners where the Permian Basin is and its importance for fossil fuel production in the United States?
Yes, absolutely. So the Permian Basin is in West Texas and parts of southeastern New Mexico. That part of Texas has been an oil-producing region for a long time, a century or so, but it was thought to have been depleted long ago, and production went into decline sometime around the 70s. But after the onset of the fracking revolution with horizontal drilling, the Permian Basin has a new lease on life, and production there has soared, and it's now, in some metrics, the largest source of oil production in the world, certainly in the United States. So the story of fracking really kind of is concentrated there, among other places, but that's the biggest one.
Why are natural gas drillers flaring off or simply venting large quantities of methane into the air, Nick?
That's a good question. So when you drill for oil and gas, when you drill for oil, gas comes up along with it. And the Texas drillers are really after the oil. So when they go and they frack a well in West Texas, a lot of gas comes up with it, called associated gas. Now, they have the pipelines to move oil to the Texas coast, which is far away. But they don't have enough pipelines to move gas. And because of that, there's a localized glut of gas trapped in the desert in West Texas, and that causes prices to crash. And instead of slowing down on the drilling operations, they're trying to move as much oil as possible, in part because they're under a lot of financial pressure. Instead, they just burn the gas into the air. Now, they say that they're working on this problem, and this is a temporary issue due to infrastructure constraints, but it's an epidemic in terms of the climate, in terms of local air quality. So it's a big problem, and then the Texas regulators are asleep at the wheel. There's certain regulations on flaring. Companies are allowed to flare in the first few weeks or months of a well coming online. So there are some limits, but the Texas Railroad Commission, which is the regulator in the state, has never denied a flaring permit to a company. They've issued thousands of permits. They issued over 5,000, I think it was, last year. So you have 5,000 times a company goes to the regulator and says, can I flare? And they say, yeah, sure, go ahead. So there really isn't a cop on the beat.
In February 2018, there was a huge methane leak from a blown gas well in Ohio. The release was so large, methane was measured from space by the Dutch. And there was more methane, they say, from this single accident than from other entire countries. Nick, why can't the industry control that?
Well, you know, there's a certain amount of risk that comes with every drilling operation, and what we've learned over the years is that methane leaks at every stage of the drilling process. It leaks at the well, it leaks in the pipeline, it leaks at compressor stations, it leaks in storage tanks. And the argument from the industry has long been that gas is a really good thing for the climate because it's going to replace coal in power plants. And there's been a big debate about how much methane is released completely wipes out that argument. And there's a debate about what threshold of methane leaks wipes out that climate benefit. But the fact is, gas is still a fossil fuel, so even if it's slightly better than coal, it's still a huge fossil fuel. But what we are learning is that the methane is leaking at faster rates than we thought. And then with the example that you cited, there are accidents where this is, you know, there's massive amounts of methane that are released from one specific project. I actually interviewed a guy who lived near that well that you're talking about, and his family had all sorts of health issues, skin rashes and respiratory problems. So there's dangers from living near the sites. It's not just a climate problem, but a local health and environmental problem.
But we do have fracking rigs right beside schools and churches and suburbs. I've seen photographs of it. It's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's in places like Colorado where the drilling is really bumping up against residential areas. That's when you get a lot more conflict. Also true in Pennsylvania and Ohio. Texas is that's the case too, but, you know, there's a lot more space too. And there's places where there's drilling where there aren't a lot of people around. But, yeah, in Colorado there's a big fight over the distance between a well and a residential area, and the industry poured in a ton of money to defeat a ballot measure. I guess it was late 2018. So, yeah, that's a big issue.
Tell us about the recent bankruptcies or stock crashes in the American gas industry, Nick.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's been more than 200 bankruptcies in the oil and gas sector in North America since 2015, which really highlights the issue of frack, which is that it's an unproven business model. Some of your listeners may know that a shale well, after initial burst of production, declines really quickly. It can lose something like 70 to 90% of its initial production within the first 3 years. So you get most of your oil and gas in that first year or two. That's very different from the conventional well or an offshore project, which once it goes online can produce pretty stably for a long time, for decades in some cases. So you've got steep decline rates from these shale wells, which means that you have to keep drilling, which means that you need money to drill the next well. The shale boom over the past decade was built largely on debt, companies borrowing money, and this has also made possible because since the financial crisis a decade ago, the global financial crisis, the Federal Reserve has kept interest rates near zero. So that means you can borrow, drillers could borrow loans at really low interest rates. And there's a lot of analysts that would say if not for that, the fracking boom never would have really taken off because it's largely built on debt. And for years, investors, Wall Street, was happy to kind of finance this thing because they expected that profits would soon be around the corner and, you know, companies would go back to Wall Street and kind of tap them again for another round of financing. Really, in the past year and a half, that narrative has kind of fallen apart, and Wall Street has gotten really sick and tired of not making any money from these drilling operations. And if you look at any of the share prices for the oil and gas companies in the U.S., since like the late 2018, the share prices have completely collapsed. And that's a reflection of the lost confidence from Wall Street. So Wall Street and the oil and gas sector have a kind of a symbiotic relationship. And the whole fracking frenzy is only really possible because of the constant reinjection of capital. So once Wall Street kind of closes off the spigot, then there's a big problem, and we're starting to see that at this point.
Tell us about the obscure Pittsburgh-based company called EQT. I'd never heard of it until I read your column.
Yeah, so EQT is actually the largest natural gas producer in the United States, and it's not a household name by any means, but it is, when you talk about shale gas drilling, EQT is kind of the giant in that space. You know, you have oil majors like Exxon and Chevron. They produce a lot of gas, but in terms of a pure shale gas company, EQT is the top name. And they bought a company called Rice Energy 2 or 3 years ago, which kind of put them in kind of the top spot in terms of gas production. And so they're based in Pittsburgh and western Pennsylvania, and this is the home of the Marcellus Shale. And so they really kind of symbolize the situation in Appalachia and the Marcellus Shale and kind of the shale gas frenzy. So there's, you know, you have Texas, but then the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania is a different thing. So EQT is the top dog there, and they their financial trouble too. They've been struggling for years. The company that they bought, Rice Energy, it was founded by a guy named Toby Rice, and he still owned some stakes in the company. He owned some stakes in EQT after he sold his company. And he kind of had, there's like a palace coup where he ousted EQT management last year because he said he could run the company better. So now he's the CEO and he's running this company, and they just last week or a couple of days ago said that they were taking a $1.8 billion write-down for the fourth quarter. So they're essentially saying their gas assets in Western Pennsylvania are not worth as much as they thought they were. And Rice has been on record saying natural gas doesn't work with prices at $2.50 per MMBTU. Prices are below that right now. So he's essentially saying the whole prospect of fracking in Western Pennsylvania is unviable at current prices. And so that's why they take this big write-down, and it's kind of a symbol of the huge financial struggles in the industry right now. And that comes after Chevron, late last year, took a $10 or $11 billion write-down, and they're basically giving up on the Marcellus Shale, and they said it couldn't work there either. So the Marcellus Shale is important because we have a decade, production has been rising for a decade, and that's why the U.S. is the top gas producer in the world, and that's why there's a huge petrochemical build-out in Appalachia and on the Gulf Coast. But we're starting to see that the finances of this whole venture are really questionable.
Yeah, Richard Heinberg wrote about this debt game in his book Snake Oil, and basically he was describing a kind of pyramid scheme.
Yeah. It's because of these steep decline rates from the wells. You have to constantly grow. You have to constantly drill. And all the money that comes out needs to be poured right back into the ground for the next well. And a lot of the oil executives like to say that they've figured this thing out, and it's a lot like manufacturing where you can kind of turn out widgets on a standardized basis. But that analogy only works if you assume you have to build a whole new factory each time. They have to drill a new well each time. Unlike conventional wells, once you drill the well, you produce for decades. These, you have to drill the wells over and over and over again just to keep production flat, let alone grow. So you need to be flying to New York to convince investors to continue to fund your operations, to keep pouring money in. And the whole notion was that they'd get costs down and then they'd eventually be profitable. But some companies are profitable, but in the aggregate, the industry has never been cash flow positive.
So if you're thinking about drilling in West Texas and you're really after the oil because you can still get some decent money for that, but the gas, you just don't have a pipeline to get rid of it yet. Now you're seeing more and more gas coming out of those wells compared to the valuable oil. I wonder, is that a sign of developing depletion of the fracking bonanza in West Texas?
Yeah, that's a great point. And the so-called gas-to-oil ratio has been rising. As you say, the oil is the lucrative part. The gas is not. And especially in Texas, where with the lack of pipelines, prices can fall as low as zero. And sometimes prices have even gone into negative territory, which means the producers have to pay somebody to take their gas away. So the gas is essentially worthless in West Texas. And the oil is really the only thing that they're after. But as these shale wells age and as the entire basin ages, the evidence is showing that a given well is starting to produce more gas relative to oil. So that it's getting gassier, if you will. Yeah, that's another kind of knock the whole financial prospect of the Permian Basin.
Nick Cunningham, what is happening with the price of oil from the Canadian tar sands, and how is that affecting the industry there? What have you heard about that?
Yeah, so the Western Canada Select, the WCS, is the price for heavy oil in Western Canada. And that price typically trades below prices in the U.S. by a couple of dollars per barrel. And that kind of reflects the fact that the quality, it's a heavier oil, it requires more processing. It also reflects the higher transportation costs for moving it across the North American continent. So that's always been the case, that it trades a few dollars per barrel below WTI, which is the price in Oklahoma and Texas. But when there's pipeline bottlenecks, that price starts to really trade at a huge discount, which is a reflection of it being kind of trapped in Alberta. So in late 2018, that price really collapsed. You had WTI U.S. prices in the 50s, and then WCS, the Canadian price, collapsed as low as $13, $14 a barrel.
Wow.
So essentially trading $40 per barrel below what oil sold for in the U.S. And that was because the oil sands operations had been adding new supply, but there wasn't any more pipelines to move it. And you got the Keystone XL pipeline, which has been bogged down for a decade. You got the Trans Mountain expansion, which has been bogged down for 5 or 6 years. A couple other projects have been canceled. There's a pipeline called Line 3 that is, I think, Enbridge is trying to replace it, which would add more capacity. That's been delayed too. And so you got several pipelines that are completely stalled, and, you know, largely because of climate activists that have stalled these projects and indigenous groups. So you got fixed pipeline capacity and rising production in Alberta. And so that led to a glut and a crash in prices. In response, the provincial government in Alberta put in mandatory production cuts last year to kind of rescue this price, which had collapsed. And it worked. The prices, Alberta producers had to cut back, and prices rebounded. And then in the last year or so, incrementally, they've been kind of gradually lifting those cuts. However, recently, the price crashed once again. So it's kind of a reflection of Alberta, the government kind of easing off these cuts a little too fast. So the long and short of it is that Alberta's been struggling to move its oil out of the province, out of the country for a long time, and those problems haven't gone away.
Well, we can see that in the economy of Alberta. And here in British Columbia, we had a lot of people coming from Alberta and buying property. That seems to have dried up, and we have people from here going there, just commuting to Alberta to work, coming home on the weekends. That's pretty well wrapped up. So it's definitely problems for the oil industry there. What other countries are announcing their own fracking booms?
So North America is really the only game in town when it comes to fracking. China has been trying to figure this out for a long time, and they've had some success. And then Argentina is kind of the other one that looms large. They've got, I think it's the second largest shale gas reserves in the world and the fourth largest oil reserves. I actually just took a trip there a few months ago and was investigating their fracking industry there. They've got a lot more challenges, financial challenges, that probably stand in the way of them replicating what the U.S. and Canada have done. They've got macroeconomic instability, a fluctuating currency, inflation, export taxes, a lot of reasons why the oil majors are kind of reluctant to go all in on it. Not to mention that they don't have enough infrastructure. They don't have pipelines. They don't have compressor stations. All this stuff kind of needs to be built from scratch. And if U.S. companies are struggling with debt and are struggling to prove that fracking can be profitable, then Argentina is kind of much further away.
Can you tell us, as we wrap up here, about other stories that you're working on these days?
Yeah, so some research I just saw, I think it came out in the last few days, talked about the petrochemical build-out on the Gulf Coast. It's important to remember that all the oil and gas that's fracked in Texas or Pennsylvania, it goes somewhere, and the story doesn't end with just the fracking. So the oil is moved by pipeline, and it moves to the Gulf Coast, and there's this massive build-out of petrochemical facilities to turn the gas into plastics, all sorts of chemicals. They need to build billion-dollar export facilities for both gas and oil. And so the Gulf Coast is kind of suffering under this huge, huge, huge wave of new facilities. And so some of the new research that just came out in the last few days estimates that the greenhouse gas emissions from this build-out could represent 10% of total U.S. emissions, which is to say it could rise by 10% because of this one sector in this one particular region. Now, that's kind of a high-end estimate because not all of these plants will be built, but it's illustrative of kind of the growth that comes after all of the fracking. And in fact, the emissions, this one report said, I forget where it was published, said that something like three-quarters of the increase in emissions is from the pipelines and all the downstream stuff, not fracking. So it's important for people to keep an eye on this because it flies beneath the radar. You know, nobody knows what ethane crackers are or other petrochemical facilities. Everybody talks about Exxon and Chevron, but the downstream is just as important and is less reported on by the media.
We have been speaking with freelance journalist and energy reporter Nick Cunningham. I check his work at oilprice.com every week because I find mind-blowing energy news not seen in other media. But Nick's stories appear all over the media. Please give your listeners your Twitter handle, Nick, so that they can get plugged in with you.
Yeah, it's Nick Cunningham and then the number one.
Nick Cunningham 1. Got it. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In our first interview, Dr. Mark Hudson thought Australia might decarbonize fairly quickly after the latest big fires. But he didn't think the country would stop exporting fossil fuels overseas. Australia is the world's biggest exporter of coal. The country recently overtook Qatar to become the world's largest exporter of natural gas. A new report from Bloomberg News shows that when we account for all the gas leaks from production through transportation and storage, liquid natural gas has a carbon footprint rivaling coal. The only hope to stop Australian exports of climate-killing fuels is for their overseas customers to stop buying. We need to get those sanctions in. We need climate activists from Australia and all countries to push solar and wind in Asia, including India. We have to stop the coal pits and gas pipes of Australia from further climate damage. There is a glimmer of hope. New data from the U.S. Energy Information Administration shows wind and solar will dominate new energy installations in America. In 2019, 76% of all new electricity generation comes from alternative green energy, while 85% of power plants closed were fired by coal and natural gas. It's going in the right direction there. The cost of wind and solar has fallen far below fossil fuels, even with government subsidies to the fossil fuel industry and no subsidies for solar or wind. The big news doesn't report that often, and we need to know that. Simple economics may drive out fossil fuels eventually, but will it happen in time? It's happening even in Arizona. The big Arizona Public Service Company just spent millions fighting off a clean energy ballot initiative. Now, they say, they want to be carbon-free by 2050 and coal-free by 2035. The Arizona utility promises to close its infamous Four Corners generating coal plant in 2031, trying for almost half renewables by 2030. Arizona is the Sunshine State, so why not be the Sunshine Powerhouse? By the way, hello to Radio EcoShock listeners in Bisbee, Arizona. In the United Kingdom, Prime Minister Boris Johnson just promised African leaders the UK would stop all direct support for coal mining and coal-fired power plants abroad. The UK pulled back from pushing coal projects, but still puts billions of pounds into helping oil and gas projects. So it's not like Johnson heard that there is a climate emergency for real. Maybe, as Kafka said, there is no hope for us. But there could be hope for the future. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and supporting this program. Radio EcoShock has broadcast for the last 14 years every week. It is now distributed free to 100 nonprofit radio stations in many countries. Thousands of people around the world download the program weekly. It is free of charge and advertising free from our website, ecoshock.org. Please tell others, in person, and by social media. Many small streams can become a mighty river. It must. Let's do what we can together.